Hello and welcome to Mistakes Were Made, a new Citywire podcast hosted by me, Alex Steger.
Oh, and me, Frank Talbot.
Brilliant. This is episode one. The listeners are going to be so impressed for the first 10 seconds. Alex speaking here. I am Citywire's editor in the mighty US of A, and I'm recording this from an impossibly small apartment in New York City.
Well, I am Citywire's head of investment research, and I'm recording this from, unfortunately, slightly less confined quarters in the county of Kent in the UK.
In many ways, this is what the world needs. After the trauma of the COVID-19 pandemic, two posh, white men, children, recording a podcast about investments. Nature really is healing.
The name of the game here is Mistakes Were Made, and the premise is that we're going to get people to confess to some of their biggest ever investment mistakes, be that professional or personal. We think this is important, you know, because I think there's real truth to the notion that you learn a lot more from your mistakes than you do for your victories. And some of these people, you know, may not be used to talking about it, but you learn a lot more about them as well. There's a great Mandela quote that goes, "I never lose, I either win or learn." And the hope is that we will too, by osmosis, learn, that is, and try to make slightly less egregious errors.
Yeah, I think that's the crux of it, isn't it? It's, you know, we're never not going to make mistakes, but perhaps we can, you know, fail better, as Samuel Beckett and some Silicon Valley tech bros might say. And we're trying to hear from a range of investors on this, you know, from people who maybe work in the fields like behavioral psychology, from those in fund selection, fund management, financial advice, to get a real array of investment views, but also mistakes. And actually, I think what we've learned from this is actually a lot of the errors are very similar, and therefore, hopefully, the lessons are pretty universal.
So we're kicking off the series with Daniel Crosby, who's a New York Times bestselling author of books such as The Laws of Wealth and The Behavioral Investor.
Yeah, he's a psychologist by training, and day-to-day he is the chief behavioral officer at a firm called Brinker Capital, which is a large wealth and asset manager based just outside Philadelphia in the US of A.
Yeah, Daniel's a very nice guy and has previously spoken... he is a nice guy, I'm being honest. He's previously spoken at Citywire events, if you remember what those were like.
Also, stick around after the interview with Daniel as you hear more, you know, gold from the likes of Frank and I. We will sort of discuss the main things that we learned from our conversation with Daniel. And of course, this is a financial podcast, so there will be some plugs, some product pushing at the end. But on to our conversation with Daniel, which we began, as we always do, by asking our guests about their worst investment decisions.
You know, if you had asked me pre-COVID, you know, I've been asked this question before, and pre-COVID, my answer was, I bought too much house. Like, you know, I live in the American South, real estate is fairly inexpensive, it's easy to get a big house, but it's also a lot of upkeep. Now I take it all back, I want every square foot of this big house. I have used every square foot of it, and it's been a lovely place to get stuck. So that was my previous worst financial mistake that I now is the best thing I ever did.
So everyone can point to the long game here. Everyone can say. No,
had I known there would be a global pandemic and I'd be stuck in my house, I would have bought twice the house I did.
Yeah. Had I known, I wouldn't have gone for the two-bedroom apartment in New York and stayed with it.
Exactly. So if I had to say now, so I'm a psychologist by education. So when I studied, I didn't study a thing about finance and knew very little about it. I had one client I was working with in financial services. I quite liked the people. I thought the work was interesting. And so I started to educate myself about how markets worked. And the thing that happened to me was that I became just educated enough to be dangerous, right? I read up on valuations, and I read up on historical market trends and cyclical 10-year valuations and how they forecast future trends. And so this is in like probably 2012 when I'm reading this, and I'm like, oh, the market is bubbly. Right, the market is bubbly. Like, this is we're at an extreme valuation here, and I've got to get out. And so I went all to cash. Right, did the very thing that I tell people not to do, because I knew at the time sort of just enough to be dangerous. And I think, you know, it, knowing what I know now, of course, the market's done nothing but go up for 9 years since that time. And I've been back in for a considerable amount of time. But there were years where I missed the good that the market had for me and my portfolio because I was sort of too clever by half.
It's funny you say that. In a way, it's reassuring, but I've made a very similar. Yeah, I've been in cash for various periods for way too long, but entirely for the same reasons. I'm like, well, this looks too much. And then every time I think about moving back in, I think, well, no, surely now is the worst time to do it. And yet another rally goes past with me on the side.
Well, it really is an occupational hazard for people like you and I, because we have to have an opinion, right? We have to follow markets enough to be able to comment sensibly on what's going on. And a danger of swimming in those waters is that you read the articles and there's always some bad news article. You know, we know from the behavioral finance literature that bad news is about 2.5 times as engaging as good news is. And so there from a very sort of practical perspective, there's always going to be some bad news that's top of mind. And you and I have to sort of immerse ourselves in that somewhat. And you have to learn to sort of rise above it, where the average person can just go blissfully on about their day, unaware of the bearish news of the day.
You sort of touched on this a little bit, but I suppose to make it explicit, what did you learn from that? What was it just about sort of that you... Was it that point of you have a dangerous amount of knowledge, or were there other sort of lessons that you took from being on the sidelines when you shouldn't have been?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of lessons that I learned. I think people have sort of different faiths when it comes to managing money, and the sort of the faith tradition, if you will, that spoke to me was sort of old school cigar butt value investing, Warren Buffett, Ben Graham stuff when I was first learning about these things. And I had a very simplistic understanding of this, like, oh, you just wait till stuff is sort of outrageously cheap and then you bet the farm. Well, years and years will go by when nothing's outrageously cheap, and that doesn't mean that markets won't continue to rise. You learn about the disconnect between the market and the economy. I've learned humility. I've learned to be intellectually curious, but to also have a process that frees you from regret. To just get in the process of contributing a little bit each month, to free yourself from the regret of trying to go all in or all out. Not something I knew at the time, but I've been appropriately humbled by the market.
So does that mean that you've bought some Bitcoin?
That does not mean that I have bought Bitcoin. I'm Bitcoin curious. I have my own podcast, and I've interviewed a number of Bitcoin enthusiasts and crypto enthusiasts. I'm interested in it. I cannot say that I've pulled the trigger yet, though, and so. Here come the have fun staying poor comments for me, I guess.
No, just living on the sidelines is tough when it's 50% up in less than 2 weeks.
Yeah, it's tough.
On that note, actually, I mean, this kind of segues nicely, I think. I wanted to, you know, you've obviously written and spoken a lot about, you know, people investing, sort of, you know, being led by their emotions. And okay, so it can be a bad decision to sit on the sidelines. It can also be a really bad decision to just join the crowd because you're reading a lot about it. And I think we see that a lot anyway. But 2020/2021, we should just invent a new word for that year, because it's one year now, isn't it? They're not really different. But we've seen that sort of on steroids, haven't we? With, most recently, obviously, the GameStop, AMC stuff and the meme stocks. Bitcoin, maybe, although maybe it's more complicated than that. Has anything, has anything changed this year or the last year and a half behaviorally? Or are we just more aware of it? And, you know, is investor behavior at its worst ever right now?
So I think there's a couple of things. Some of them are as old as human nature itself, right? I mean, some of the AMC GameStop stuff, I mean, that's just classic right? Feeding frenzy, mania, market bubbles, right? That's been around for hundreds of years. It'll be around hundreds of years hence. And then you throw the pandemic on top of it, right? This is unprecedented. We were lonely before this. You know, the UK and Japan in 2018 created ministries of loneliness because their citizenry was so lonely that it was having dramatic health impacts. In the US, half of people say they're lonely. And in the US, we've studied the impact of social isolation on people. It's equivalent to being twice as damaging as obesity. It's the equivalent to smoking 15 cigarettes a day. Like, social isolation is terrible for people. And so when we see that there's a group of upstart young investors who are trying to stick it to the man, like, that was a narrative, right? That was a form of social cohesion that was very alluring to a lot of people at a time when people were profoundly, profoundly socially disconnected. That offered the feeling of connection. So I think you've got old school investor behavior, you've got real time updates via technology, and you've got a lonely populace. It was sort of the perfect storm.
So I just want to go back to something there. So you're saying if I have loads of friends and I'm not lonely, I could maybe take up smoking and I'd be net kind of
you could eat a lot of potato chips and start smoking. And no, but when they
need, but I need to have friends. Oh, it's tough, isn't it? What do I want more? Oh.
No, but when they study longevity, I mean, there's lots of places like Italy, right? There's parts of Italy where people sit around and you know, the prevalence of smoking is enormously high. You know, they're of course eating cheese and pasta all day, delicious bread, right? And people are not in great health in many respects, and yet they live long lives because there's an enormous amount of social connectedness. And so offsetting fouls, you know, pick up an overeating and a smoking habit, but just keep those friends close.
Sweet. Okay. That's a new goal, I think, for this year for me. Although I know you don't believe, I've read some stuff. He's like, don't really set goals and don't do them annually. But Frank, did you want to come in on anything here?
Yeah, actually, what was your most recent investment decision? Why'd you make it? Because the reason I ask is because I've heard that you like to get in the right mood to make a decision. You've got to be calm, thinking clearly, no emotional response. So how did you get in the mood? And then what did you make?
Frank, I'm married, Frank. And this is not, no, my latest investment was the one that I make every month. I mean, I invest in sort of a diversified basket of different asset classes. It's a decidedly unsexy event. You know, it's just something I do every 2 weeks. And so for me, it's muscle memory at this point. It's just reflexive. It's what I do every payday. And so my latest investment was like my last investment and the 10 before it, and not much to write home about, but a good way to keep me out of my own way.
And does that transcend to buying stuff on Amazon? I've been reading that a lot of people, what's it called? Emotional spending during the pandemic is well up. People just getting that dopamine hit of just firing something towards Amazon.
Now that I'm terrible about. The thing that's going to fill the hole in my heart most recently is the 1950s gold top Les Paul guitar I just ordered. So that's the thing that's going to make me happy this month. We got my fingers crossed that this is the thing that's finally going to do it.
For listeners out there, there are a fair few guitars on the wall behind him.
And Frank, have you not also made some quite bad COVID purchases recently?
Not so much. I mean, I've got a young kid, so we've been buying stuff that possibly we don't need, like the sterilizer that has never once been used apart from to test out that it was working.
I was thinking more, you mentioned to me there's a golf club that you might have bought recently.
Oh, yeah. So I bought a golf club because it was on discount, and golf courses have been closed in England for virtually the entire year. So I haven't had much time to use it, but it was nice and shiny and it was cheap.
It's a value play. It will come back. And Daniel, I guess, you know, we touched on this a bit already, but, you know, are there things that people can do? You know, you, Frank mentioned it there somewhat suggestively about, you know, you getting in the mood. But are there things that people can do to sort of counteract sort of behavioural, but natural behavioural biases when making investment decisions? Are there ways, psychological ticks that you can be aware of that you could try to control or stop yourself, or, you know?
Yeah, so I think the two biggest things that people can do are automate their process. and work with a professional. Those are the two best things that they can do. For most people, automating the process is just beats everything else. Because when you look at the research on willpower and discretionary decision making, we have sort of a finite reserve of willpower, and it's easily used up, I think, especially at a time like right now when so much other stuff is going wrong and we're trying to hold it together. And so what we see is that people who are exercising willpower in one area tend to let it slip in another. And so rather than trying to white knuckle your way to good investing, I think the best thing you can do is just set a good process in place and automate it so that it just sort of occurs beneath your awareness and you don't have the propensity to get in there and screw yourself up. The second thing you can do is to work with a professional who can kind of guide you through the process and keep you on the straight and narrow path. The third thing I would say is that emotion is the enemy. You know, Frank alluded to this. Emotion is the enemy of sound decision-making of all sorts. So if you're excited about an investment idea, it is almost necessarily stupid. If you are scared, if you are scared about your investments, you're probably being foolish as well. So, I mean, kind of like I talked about with my biweekly purchases, I mean, the best investment decisions don't raise your heart rate one bit. And there's a lot of people right now making really emotionally led decisions. Some people are getting super rich on it. Many more people are left holding the bag and are going to be very poor on it, because getting rich quick and getting poor quick are sides of the same coin.
That makes perfect sense. And we write a lot of what CityY does is writing for all of it is writing for sort of professional investors, but a big part of that audience is, I suppose, what we call sort of fund selectors, fund buyers. So maybe they're not necessarily sort of client facing advisors, but they're people who put together buy lists or put together model portfolios and things. And I'd be interested in your views, if you have any, on kind of common mistakes when picking a fund manager.
I think respectfully, I think one of the things that sort of the institutional, fund managers do is they don't understand that they're people too. I think there can be this misapprehension of how we are just as prone to behavioral bias as the next person. Indeed, you and I who work in the industry, we've sort of been out with some of our stupid investment decisions we've made. And people who are professionals are prone to all the same things as retail investors, and sometimes may lack the humility to understand that that's the case. So I think the first thing is to understand that if there's something that people are prone to do, you're prone to do it too, and you need to be on guard against those things. A second thing we do as humans is we tend to extrapolate the present moment into the future indefinitely, right? We tend to think that whatever is happening now is going to continue, going to persist into the future. And that's what leads us to chase performance. And what's true in life is what's true in life in many contexts is, what you see is what you get. Like, I met you in New York 3 years ago. You were wry and funny and intelligent. You're all those things again today. There you go, right?
Stop it.
I know.
We emailed before, Frank. I'm sorry.
I thought you were married.
Yeah, I am married, but it won't stop me from flirting here. No, but it's like when you meet someone, you expect them to be the same person again, and typically they are. The truth about markets, though, is the inverse of that. The truth about markets is that this too shall pass. So we see things from the professional world that, fund managers who get fired tend to outperform the fund managers that replace them, right? We know that. And so we know that professionals, overlook their behavioral biases. We know that professionals chase performance. We know that they do all these things. So you have to have a process that you believe in. More so than performance.
A lot of these people, they are face to face, or at least they did pre-COVID, with these fund managers. Is there a sort of series of questions you can ask them to understand their personality traits? Red flags that you would think, ooh, if they might have said that, that's sketchy. I don't want to get involved there.
I have written about how I don't think that I don't think that fund selectors should meet with fund managers. All the research on our ability to tell truth from falsehood when face to face with someone shows that we suck at it, like we're horrible at it, and that we're also susceptible to things like flattery, right? Even when we know that we're being flattered, people still love flattery. And so if you think about, you know, all these different behavioral phenomena that go into like a due diligence trip for a fund manager, like, you know, you fly out to visit them, you stay in a hotel, there's all these sunk costs, right? So from the get-go, you want it to go well. Like you're already wanting to believe in them, because if you don't, you perceive that trip as sort of a wasted effort. Then you know that they're going to be on their best behavior and flattering you and being kind to you and putting their best foot forward. You're susceptible to all of that. None of us are these like sort of micro expression detectives that we watch, you know, watch on TV. That stuff just isn't very robust, and we have a coin flip chance of telling truth from falsehood. So I think all the information you need is in the data. I think that things like shaking hands with a fund manager, looking them in the eye, I think it has sort of old school, it makes us overconfident. It makes us more confident than it is helpful. When you look at the data on like gambling, sports gambling, right? People who get 3 pieces of data are no better at selecting a winner than people who get 20 pieces of data. But the people who have 20 pieces of data are way more confident in their picks. So they take bigger bets. They don't manage their risk as well. I don't think a whole lot of good comes out of looking someone in the eye and shaking their hand and you know, seeing if you like the cut of their jib, right? But yet we think that it does, and it has this sort of old school appeal that's hard to shake from people. So sorry, listeners.
It's interesting. We've interviewed a guy before who, a fan selector, who is now, I don't think, in the job he was, so I'm not going to say who he is, but who had the same approach. And he cited, I'm going to try and get this right, is Daryl Morey, who used to be the general manager at the...
Oh, the Houston Rockets.
Houston Rockets, there you go. Look, once I was in American sports, I was on really dangerous ground. But he had the same thing. He wrote a big thing all about... he didn't interview the players. He just looked at the numbers. He said the interviews did nothing for him. But yeah, I guess the counter would be, a lot of our readers would sort of say that they, you know, it's more than the cut of the jib. You can sort of tell who's really running things there. You can see if there's a succession plan. You can see, you know, how other analysts sort of respond to the managers. I don't know. I'm trying to present the counter view here, you know, to ward off the complaint letters.
Listen,
does that have any merit, or doesn't really hold water?
I'm not trying to kill your conference business, Alex. I hope you guys. Here's what I think. If you're going to do that, because I have no misgivings about the fact that people are going to ignore this advice from me. So if you're going to do this, I would say just have a process-driven approach. Like have a checklist, right? Because one of the things that we know is that certain things loom larger in our mind than other things. So, you know, you return back from this due diligence trip, and let's say you saw 3 things you liked and 3 things you didn't like. You know, you're not going to weigh all those things equally. And maybe the fact that, you know, you two like the same same Premier League team has a halo effect that's bigger than the fact that maybe some things were out of line. And so I just think you have to have a process, and don't let the relational niceties, don't let the soft things overcome your process, because everyone's still going to do this. No one's going to listen to me. I've been screaming into the abyss for years about this.
No, fair enough. Thank you. And Frank, on our back and forth before, you were going to ask Daniel, we've touched on it perhaps a bit already, but about the irrationality index.
Oh yeah, so you know, coming back, I think Alex pretty much asked you at the beginning, you know, are we at the least rational point in history? You know, what is, do you still run the index? What's it saying?
I haven't done, I'm revamping. I haven't looked at it in years, honestly. But here's what I will say about that, though. Here's why I think we might be at the least rational point of the recent past. If we look at how people make sense of something, There's something in psychology called primacy and recency, where the first thing that happens to us in a series of events looms large in our minds, and the most recent thing in a series of events looms large. So if you look at people who are investing today, whether in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, whatever, almost all of them now cut their teeth on some weird market. You know, was it the tech bubble or the mania preceding the tech bubble and the tech bubble? Was it the great financial crisis? Was it the corona crisis? Almost everyone investing today has an early experience of something wild and a recent experience of something wild. And so I think people have gotten a really volatile notion of what markets mean. And I mean, last year was like 1929 and 1999 in the same year. I mean, it was absolutely bonkers, right? It was like the Great Depression and this great bubble in the same 12-month span. And so I think investors are primed to make some of the worst decisions of all time right now. And the work that we do as an industry, I think, is more important than ever right now to just keep people from you know, getting in their own way.
I'm selling everything.
All in cash, just, yeah. That's what I can take from this is, to go full circle, we're all going to sell out of everything, we're going to sit in cash, and we're going to miss out on another 10 years, and we're going to sue you. I guess to sort of round this off, we've asked you a lot about bad decisions and sort of where things go wrong. I think it's only fair to let you brag a little bit as well. So what would have been your best decisions other than, well, maybe you answered it around sort of having something that's automated, having something regular, but any other kind of, you know, high quality, good decisions that stand out?
A few. I think one of them is learning from my mistake, right? Like learning from my big mistake that I started with. You know, there's psychological momentum when you make a mistake to keep sort of patting yourself on the back for that decision that you made. You know, we each want to believe that we're, you know, both intelligent and virtuous. These are sort of the two things. We want to believe we're good people, and we want to believe that we're smart people. And so it's hard for us to look at a decision we made and go, that was dumb. So, you know, I was able to do that. It took a bit, but, you know, eventually I was able to get there. So that's one good decision I made. The second good decision I made was to maximize my income. Like, you know, I've done a lot of things that have put me in a position to have, you know, income that I'm able to save. I think one of the things that we can do that we don't talk about much, we're always talking about squeezing, you know, half a, you know, 50 basis points of alpha out of this asset class or another, where it's much easier for you to just go, you know, whatever, start a side hustle, write a book, pick up a new skill, and make a couple of extra bucks yourself and use those to try and get ahead. So I think I've done a good job of building a successful career that's allowed me to save and invest. And I think I realized my own stupidity fairly early on, which is both things have served me well.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So again, just to reiterate the lessons from this, move to cash, drive for Uber. That's what I'm taking out from this.
Busking, that's why I have the guitars, yeah.
I doubt you go busking with a gold Les Paul. I think people might look at you and go, I'm not sure that you need the money. I don't know, from a marketing standpoint. It's rich, isn't it? It's asking a lot. Well, there you go. That was our conversation with Daniel Crosby. I should actually at this point say thank you very much, Daniel, Les. I think we did thank him, but we obviously didn't do it while we were recording. So little rude ending there. But you know, it was lovely to hear from Daniel. I think a sort of a perfect guest to kick off this series. And for those of you who want to hear more from him, he has his own podcast with the enviably good name of Standard Deviations, which, as you would expect, also kind of focuses on behavioral investing. And if you want to read more from him, obviously he's written those books that Frank mentioned. I think he has a blog as well on the Brinker Capital website, so do check that out. I really enjoyed that, Frank, and I think I learned a lot. Obviously, I've made some of the same mistakes as Daniel, so maybe I haven't fixed them as quickly as he has. What did you take from it?
I like the notion that you've got to be devoid of emotion when making an investment decision. That kind of shades of American Psycho in it. Maybe not. Maybe
I'm not sure. That, not. I don't know what that, if that's really what American Psycho is about. There's not a lot of financial decisions made. It's more.
Well, you've kind of got to be a stone cold killer about these things, and not dwell on it, and not get too wrapped up. I like the idea that if you're excited about anything, it's a bad decision. I might try and take that into other aspects of my life.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, I thought that was very interesting. Obviously, as discussed, I've sat in cash often and for too long. I thought there were some interesting points there around obviously fund managers are people too, just because they're very well remunerated and literally professional investors doesn't mean they are immune to the same sort of foibles and faults as the rest of us. I like the idea that sociability can improve your health, but I guess on a more serious note, it was very interesting to hear the role that Daniel thinks loneliness might be playing in some of the investment behavior that we've been seeing at the moment. And I don't think that's been discussed enough. A lot of people have talked about stimulus checks, lack of sports being on as to why perhaps you're seeing more people pile into trading, particularly in the US. But I don't think the loneliness element of it has got the same attention. So I thought that was a very interesting point to take.
Yeah, I don't think you were alone in that. Coming back to the cash point, I think there was a lot of people over the last 10 plus years in that bull market that went on the defensive, be that in cash or taking out protection. And that's a huge factor in why our performance rates of portfolio managers have been so low in terms of the percentages, because how could it possibly keep going on? And yet, if you'd have sat on your hands, you'd be sitting pretty. A point to note on that, though, is that if you were a US investor investing in US stock markets, you're happy as Larry. But there were other parts of the world that didn't just go straight up all the time with tech fueling their rallies.
Wait. Stocks don't just go up.
Well, according to Reddit, they do just go up, and this is how you market time.
Before we go, we've given Daniel's work a bit of a plug, and rightly so. But of course, we should also do some shameless self-promotion, as if this podcast alone isn't enough of that. So, for those of you listening to this in the United States who aren't familiar with CityWire and our output, do check out citywireusa.com. Where we write for both professional fund selectors and registered investment advisors. And of course, you can catch Frank's work across almost all CityWire properties, whether in the US, Europe, and the UK. So maybe just Google his name, who knows? Anyway, I think that's a good point to end it. So thank you all very much for listening to this first ever episode of Mistakes Were Made. It's goodbye from me, Alex Steger.
And goodbye from me, Frank Talbot.